Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the privateer, number 511, on the state of the economy worldwide, right after this. You know, when you make $50,000 a year, you pay about $7,650 of that in Social Security taxes. Then you pay a 17% income tax on that $50,000. Now, that's another $8,500. Now, that means that you just paid an extra $1,300 by paying your tax on a tax. And that makes the real effective Social Security tax rate 17.8%. It's not the 15.3% that's being advertised. Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call me at 417-273-4967 and help take a bite out of crime. Call and ask for my free general law CD package. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. And tax and status is available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, just go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email. Send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were talking about the privateer issue, number 511. The real state of the world economy is not the pabulum that we're hearing from our presidential candidates. There's really no difference between George Bush and John Kerry as far as economic policy is concerned. Both of them are committed to Social Security, not the solution of the Social Security problem, but we're going to continue with more of the same. Same thing with Medicare. As I showed you last time, that we have a potential $47 to $72 billion shortfall over the baby boom generation. And all politicians know that Social Security is near and dear to the hearts of Americans. It is the eighth plank to the Communist Manifesto, and we Americans have adopted communism as if we invented it. We not only have adopted it, we believe in it. We practice it. We practice it like nobody else in the world practices it, and we believe in it. And of course, there's a cause and effect relationship that comes from that. Now, the massive debt bubble that is hanging over the world's economy is caused by the United States of America. We're the ones that began the process back in 1932 when we elected Franklin D. Roosevelt and adopted these 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto and free trade. We got with the bargain Social Security. Now we have Medicare. We have abandoned the gold standard. They took our gold away, then they took our silver coin away. We have a fiat currency. And the American dollar, the U.S. dollar, has been destroyed, past tense. It's not something that's coming in the future. It's already been accomplished. The purchasing power of the dollar has gone from 100 cents to 3.5 cents in 70 years, from 1934 to 2004. So it's been well managed, I'll concede that. We never would have thought that you could have debased the currency in such an orderly fashion as has occurred from 1929 through about 2000. But nevertheless, we've got 3.5 cents of the value of it left. It's the currency of choice. It's the world's reserve currency, and it's about as valueless as the Mexican peso. I can remember back in 1958 when I would take my winter vacation. I'd go down to Mexico and spend a month down there and then come back and start milking cows again around March. And so in January and February, you know, when we're just feeding the cows and things are kind of slow, I'd take off and go down to Mexico, and a dollar would buy 12 and a half pesos. So when you went in for a petite dinner, you know, at the Phoenix Hotel, you'd buy a steak dinner, and it would be about 12 pesos, about $12. Today, you can't buy a steak dinner for $12 in the United States. It costs 18 to 25. In those days, you could get a Coke or a Pepsi for about 60 centavos. Today, a Coke or a Pepsi costs you about a dollar in a vending machine. So the money in America today is worth less than the Mexican peso was in 1958 to 1960. Now, our money is turning to confetti because we followed the same policies that we saw the Latin Americans follow in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. We watched their money inflate until it went out of sight, 5,000% or something like that a year. And then when it self-destructed, they'd come up with a new one. And then they go on from there. But every time these currencies collapse, every time these currencies go through this hyperinflation, there's a massive change of ownership in the property. The farms, the ranches, the houses, and the businesses change owners. And that's what we're facing in the United States. There's going to be a massive change in ownership here very shortly. Now, the presidential candidates and the political parties don't want to talk about that. But the Privateer, published down in Australia, does that twice a month. And every once in a while, I'll take one of these issues. It's what many people call gloom and doom. I call it opportunity on the hoof. Opportunity is like rain. It's everywhere. And when it's not there, you can create it. So I don't want to see the American dollar collapse. I'm sorry to see the massive dislocations in the world's economy, but then I didn't create it. So don't get mad at me if I profit from it. Now, great profits were made in the Depression of the 1930s. Of course, there was a lot of unemployment and misery for those that got caught up in it. It's like the sinking of the Titanic. There were 1,500 victims and 800 survivors. And in the 1920s, there were many, many victims, and there were a few survivors. And out of the survivors, some of them made a lot of money at it. Let's take a look and see if there's some opportunity here. Now, over the 10 years, between 1992 and 2001, the average U.S. current account deficit was $189 billion. In 2002 and 2003, the figures soared to $473 billion and $530 billion in 2002 and 2003. Now, let me run those numbers by you again. Let's think about this. In the 10 years between 1992 and 2001, take $190 billion a year. Let's take 190 and divide that by 12. We were spending about $15 billion a month more on imported goods than we exported. Now, that's not good. You know, over time, that debt will come back and force you into bankruptcy. But $15 billion a month out of an economy of around, you know, $8, $9, $10 trillion a year isn't the end of the world. It's what we call manageable. Then in just 2 years, in 2002 and 2003, just each one of those years, let's take 2002, the figures soared to $473 billion. Now let's take a look at the year 2003 compared to the average of 1992 to 2000, and we get 473 divided by 12. Now that's $39 billion a month. So it goes from 15, 30, 45. That's 2.5 times. Now take a look at what happens the very next month, or the very next year, 2003. It goes to $530 billion. So let's take $530 billion. Let's divide that by 12. And that's $44 billion. So compared to the 1990s, we're now spending 3 times as much is the deficit. It's the shortfall. It's what we can't afford, but we're buying on credit. Now how long can that go on? I don't know. You see, I'm amazed that it's gone on this long. Absolutely amazed. And so are most economists. We're sitting here saying, wow, that's really something. Alan Greenspan, the miracle worker, has spent us into bankruptcy, and we have continued on and made our payments longer than anyone could have imagined. Now, nobody comes along and says, oh, well, I've got a solution for Social Security or Medicare or the balance of payments deficit. You don't have John Kerry saying, look, elect me because I'm going to pay off these debts. I'm going to balance our budget. I'm going to balance our balance of payments. And that's because there's no solution to it. Or if there is, there isn't anybody out there that knows what it is. And I don't hear any of the presidential candidates talking about this. This is the real time bomb in the presidential debates. We should be talking about, well, what's the solution to Social Security and what are you going to propose, Mr. President, when you're elected? Nobody said a word about it. And that's because nobody's got a word to say about it. It's like talking about sex at the dinner table. You know, that's something that we don't want to talk about. The opposite side of this outflow of U.S. dollars can be starkly seen in China. At the end of 2000, China's foreign exchange reserve was about $165 billion. By the end of 2002, it had skyrocketed to $286 billion. Then it soared to $403 billion by the end of 2003. And by the end of June of this year, 2004, the Chinese reserve, dollar reserve, was at a staggering $470 billion. Now look at that. They went from 165 to 470. Let's take 470 and divide that by 165. And it's 2.8. It nearly tripled. Nearly tripled in 3 years. So here we Americans are buying all of this stuff from the Chinese. And we're paying them with dollars. We give them our IOUs. We're not paying them with Caterpillar tractors or with Microsoft or with something that, you know, we're trading a pocket knife for a dog or something like that. We're trading, we're taking the pocket knife, but we're giving them a piece of paper that says, someday we will give you a dog or a Caterpillar tractor, or we'll give you a car, or we'll do something for you. Now, the Chinese are sitting over there on this favorable balance of payments side of the ledger. That's where we Americans used to be in the 1950s and 60s, up until the 1970s. We were the creditor nation of the world. Today, we're the world's number one debtor nation. And the debtor is servant to the lender. Now, think about that, because there's an ultimate end that comes from this, an ultimate end. Now, many people don't like to face reality, and so they say, well, you know, what are they going to do? We've got nuclear weapons. Well, so do they. Well, you know, okay, we owe it to them, so we're just not going to pay them. Okay, so then they're just not going to send you any tennis shoes. Well, what do we care? We'll just buy them from somebody else. Who's going to send you tennis shoes expecting you to get paid in worthless dollars when you didn't pay the Chinese? Well, think about it. When you're a debtor and you don't pay your bills, there are consequences that come from that. And the same thing is true with nations and empires. Stand by. We'll be back with more on the state of the economy when we return right after this. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States, worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Gordon Law School and The Law Hour, please go to the website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. And The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it's open to individuals by prearrangement only. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives. And it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. And all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. All right, we're talking about the state of the world's economy from the perspective of the privateer. The privateer is published 25 issues a year by, if I can find the first page here, William A.M. Buckler, Post Office Box 2004, Noosa Heads, that's N-O-O-S-A, Heads, Queensland, Australia, 4567, I guess is the zip code. And they've got a webpage, it's www.the-privateer.com. So that's www.the-privateer.com. Or the email is capt@the-privateer.com. Again, that's capt@the-privateer.com. It sells for $180 Australian. It's about $130 a year American, worth every dollar. We're talking about the balance of payments deficit. The Chinese have scored big on us, and their score on us from the 1990s in profits has been spectacular. In fact, it's a renvoi. It is a turnaround of biblical proportions. I can't ever remember in American history this ever falling to us. Now, we made a lot of money. We lent a lot of money. We had a great balance of payments ledger in the 1950s, but nothing like this. $470 billion the Chinese are sitting on in foreign reserves and dollars that we owe them. That's a half a trillion. In short, China has now added slightly more than $300 billion to its stock of foreign exchange reserves, mainly in the form of U.S. dollars, and they've done this in only 3.5 years. The U.S. got the Chinese produced consumer goods, and they also got the U.S. dollars that they had paid China for these goods back in the form of loans made to the U.S. Treasury and U.S. agencies and U.S. banks, all of which spent that money back into circulation inside the United States, from whence some of it flowed back to China again. So the cycle continues up until now. Now, look at the insanity of this. Here are the Chinese producing, and they send us $100 billion worth of goods, and we don't pay them. We don't give them gold or silver or wheat, corn, beans, honey, or oil. We give them treasury paper. We give them dollars. We give them bonds. We give them some kind of commercial paper. They put that on their books as foreign reserves and turn around and lend those foreign reserves back to the United States. But it gets better as we look at the story. They're now taking the foreign reserves and buying businesses, factories in foreign countries like the United States. They're turning around and buying our infrastructure. It's kind of like going to a national park, and it's called a UN biosphere. We don't own Yellowstone Park. The United Nations owns it. The United Nations is a corporation, just like the United States of America is a corporation. And our corporation, the United States of America, is spinning off our national parks and selling them to various and sundry other corporations. No, boys and girls, that's not a public park. No, boys and girls, that's not your public park. That belongs to the United Nations now. Now look at what the Chinese are doing. They're buying up businesses around the world so that they can get out of these dollars. They're not dumb. They can see that this dollar's purchasing power is on its way down and out. They can see that they're holding worthless paper from a deadbeat creditor that can't pay his bill. And they're not going to sit there and take the loss, but they've got a dilemma. You see, about half of their economy is based upon exports to the rest of the world, primarily the United States. Now, the Asian central banks currently hold about $2.2 trillion. Did you get that? Now, a trillion is 1,000 billion. So 2.2 trillion is $2,200 billion. That's 80% of the world's total official foreign exchange reserves. Asian central banks, that's Japan and Singapore and South Korea and Formosa and China, the Pacific Rim, you know, our trading partners in the Far East. They've got 80% of all of the world's official foreign exchange reserves. Now, the Bank for International Settlements and their data reveals that as of the end of 2003, U.S. dollar-denominated assets made up about 70% of these Asian reserves. And this is where the Asian central banks, which are now holders of this huge U.S. dollar stockpile, have made a future big stick for their own backs. If they had not intervened when this accelerating flow of U.S. dollars started to arrive in their markets, the increased supply of U.S. dollars against a nearly unchanged demand for U.S. dollars would have acted to cause the U.S. dollar to fall in its exchange value against their own national currencies. But by having decided to intervene actively so as not to let their own currencies climb against the U.S. dollar, they have instead ended up with these huge amounts of foreign exchange reserves as well as standing as the biggest global creditors against the U.S. global debtor. So here we Americans have now changed places. We are the debtor. We are the tail and not the head. Just the exact opposite from what our God told us. He said to us, you will be the head and not the tail. Now we find that we're the tail and not the head. Now, in sum, what the Asian central banks have jointly done is to stand against the natural action of the world market for currencies. Now, or at some time in the near future, they will have to pay the price. That future real price to be paid will hit when some or all of these Asian central banks stop supporting the international value of the U.S. dollar. And as soon as that happens, the U.S. dollar will start falling, and it will fall rapidly. And as it falls, it will be that huge stock of reserves amounting to $2.2 trillion, which falls in value as measured against the Asian currencies against which the U.S. dollar is falling. Now, that just happened in Russia 2 or 3 years ago. The Russians just closed the bank on Friday and reopened with a new currency on Monday, and they devalued it. So if you had $1,000 in the bank, and if bread was a dollar a loaf, you had 1,000 loaves of bread in the bank on Friday, and on Monday when the bank opened, you had 600 loaves of bread. Now, that's where these Asians and the Asian central banks are setting. When the value of the dollar falls, the purchasing power is going to fall with it. Now, what a dilemma to be in. Now, you say, well, that's good for our guys. No, that's not so good for our guys either. There's a penalty for us to pay also. So if the U.S. dollar were to fall in value by 20%, the Asian central banks stand to lose on their own books about $440 billion in purchasing power. And the only way to avoid that now, that assured future loss, is for these Asian central banks to continue their U.S. dollar support at the price of reserves, which climb towards $3, $4, $5, $6, $8, $10 trillion. I mean, where is it going to end? What if you were lending money to a guy that couldn't pay you? And he's you know, into you for $3,000. You're going to loan him another $1,000, make it $4, another $1,000, make it $5, another $1,000, make it $6. Especially if this guy is your number one customer. I mean, this is the guy that's buying from you. Well, the United States has assets. And it's like the Japanese buying Rockefeller Center. Or the United Nations having Yellowstone Park turned over to them. I don't think they paid anything for them. I think we just gave it to them. So we have a lot of assets here in the United States. We have raw materials. We have forests. And we have mines. And we have oil. And we have all of these assets and raw materials. And those are going to be foreclosed on because they're being mortgaged. And you and I, as citizens and taxpayers, are what are known as surety underwriters. In the insurance business, we would be what's known as a surety underwriter for the debt. Now, what did God tell us about surety and suretyship? Mull it over, you know, because we were told, don't do that. And we said, well, God, you made a mistake. You don't understand international and foreign finance and international geopolitics, so we're going to fix your mistakes. We're going to go out here and create stock markets and paper money and Federal Reserve banks, treaties, and we're going to go out here in the marketplace and cut a fat hog in the back. Well, in sum, what these Asian central banks have jointly done is to stand against the natural action of the world market for currencies. So now, or in the near future, they're all going to have to pay the price. And that future real price to be paid will hit when some or all of that Asian, the central Asian bank stops supporting this international value of the U.S. dollar. And as soon as that happens, the U.S. dollar will start falling. And as it falls, it'll be that huge stock of reserves, that $2.2 trillion. and they're going to stand to lose at 20%. Now, who's to say that it's going to fall 20%? Maybe it'll be 50%. They'll lose half. Now, when those guys take a bath, you know, when the Chinese don't get paid and they take a bath, are they going to continue to work for 50 cents on the dollar? When they were working for 100 cents on the dollar, they didn't get paid. And then they took a 50 cent on the dollar loss. Do you think they're going to continue to work for us at the same rate, sending the same number of tennis shoes and the same number of big screen TVs for 50 cents on the dollar? Would you do that? If you were loaning money to somebody and he stiffed you for half of it, would you continue to work just as hard for half as much money in the future? I mean, come on, boys and girls, I can't picture that. So if they continue their present U.S. dollar support policies, all of the Asian central banks set themselves up for even bigger losses when the inevitable point is reached where they cannot continue. The longer this policy does continue, the bigger assured losses the Asian central banks pile up for themselves. Now, I suspect that what they've got is some kind of an undercover deal here with the U.S. president, the current administration, the Republicans, to maintain the value of the dollar until after the elections. Then it'll collapse. Now, evidently, the administration has agreed that, well, okay, when the dollar collapses, we will pay you with assets. We will pay you with something, U.S. land, public land, maybe. I don't know. There's some kind of a deal there. I wouldn't have continued this long. I don't think any rational person would have continued this long lending money to a debtor they know they can't collect money for or collect money from unless they had some kind of a backdoor deal. Well, hang on. We'll explore that backdoor deal and what's coming down internationally right after this. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, when the federal income tax was launched back in 1913, the tax was levied only on the super wealthy, the richest one-half of 1% of our population, and with a top tax rate of only 7%. Well, today, the fears of those early opponents of the income tax have been more than fully realized, because by the end of Herbert Hoover's term, back in 1932, that top tax rate had jumped to 60%. And by the time Franklin D. Roosevelt was done, the top rate was over 90%, and the tax had been dramatically expanded to seize the incomes of the middle class for the first time. Now, in 1913, the average family had to work until January 30th in order to earn enough to satisfy the tax man. Now, this year, the average American family has to work all the way through May 12th in order to earn enough to pay their federal, state, and local tax bills. Now, when you compare this to the plight of medieval serfs, says economist Daniel J. Mitchell, they only had to give the lord of the manor a third of their output, and they were considered slaves. Now, what do you think that makes us? This income tax and Social Security tax violate three of the Ten Commandments and eight statutes of the Old Covenant, including our English common law. And the income tax and Social Security tax are two criminal activities. And that's because the income tax is the second plank to the Communist Manifesto, and Social Security is the eighth plank to the Communist Manifesto. And that's why I contend that you owe it to yourself to at least ask the question, do I really want to participate in this kind of criminal activity? Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, just call the law school at 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school, and it's entertaining, educational, informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. Tax and status is also available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, you can go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and then send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the privateer. This is issue number 511, published in Noosa Heads, Queensland, Australia. All right, meanwhile, as long as the Asian central banks and their policy of U.S. dollar support in their operations are still in effect, the U.S. economy gets a real economic free ride by having its trade and current account deficits. See, that's our trade deficit and our internal federal U.S. deficit. We get those deficits funded externally. We just borrow the money. Now, the U.S. Treasury also gets a free ride in funding its massive budget deficits, since they, too, are being externally funded. So while all of this is going on, next nobody inside the United States stands forward to sound the alarm. We're not hearing this from Kerry or Bush or Ralph Nader or anybody else. And even as the U.S. external debts climb higher and higher, as the U.S. dollars flow out of our nation, this is just another part of the blissful and undisturbed delusion which most in America suffer from. Now, a fall in the international value of the U.S. dollar is now an assured certainty. The only thing still to be seen is whether the break in its global value happens before November the 2nd or after November the 2nd. Now, I'm going to pick after November the 2nd. There's some kind of a deal cooking here behind the scenes between the Chinese, the Japanese, and the Republican administration in Washington. These people in China and Japan aren't stupid, you know. So they've made some kind of a backdoor deal, and you can rest assured that that deal is going to be made at your expense. That's why I've been sounding the alarm and telling my listeners and telling my readers, it's time for us to take evasive action. It's time for us to start looking for another way off the Titanic. I always tell my students, we have a little exercise here, you know, in subsistence and survival. I say, well, what would you do if you had 48 hours advance warning that the Titanic was going to sink? I mean, just picture yourself. Here you are riding on the world's greatest ship, you know, the unsinkable Titanic. And let's say I come up to you and I say, Bob, wait a minute, I just had a dream. And in my dream, this ship hits an iceberg at 20 minutes to 12 on the 14th, and the ship sinks in 2 hours and 20 minutes. What would you say to that? Wouldn't you say, George, you're delusional. You know, it's just a dream. And I said, no, Bob, it's real. I say in 24 or 48 hours, the ship is going to sink. And 1,500 people are going to get killed and 800 people are going to survive. And only one boat gets away with men and women. That's Lifeboat 6, the first one off at 12 o'clock midnight. And then all of the men have to stand on the ship and go down with the ship. Only women and children get in the lifeboats. Well, now let's suppose that you and I are agreed that this is the event. Now, we want to prevent this catastrophe. So where would we start? Well, wouldn't we go to the captain? Wouldn't we go to Captain Smith and say, now, Captain Smith, we've got this problem. I had a dream, and the ship is going to sink. It's going to hit an iceberg, and it's going to sink in 2 hours and 20 minutes, and 1,500 people are going to get killed. Now, Captain Smith has been sailing for 39 years. And what have you been doing for a living for the last 39 years? This captain probably has more sailing experience and more sailor experience than you have years of life. You're probably not even 39 years old. And I'm sure the captain would be condescending, and he'd give you a couple of free tickets to the A-deck lounge and say, here, have a couple of drinks on the White Star Line. Sit back, relax, enjoy yourself. Don't worry about a thing. The ship is unsinkable. I've been sailing for 39 years. You're in safe hands with Harlan and Wolf and the White Star Line. I don't think that Captain Smith is going to listen to some guy that's had a dream. Now, the next solution, I guess, for us is to go to the crew to see if we can't convince some of the crew that our concerns are really true and sincere. And so we start talking to crew members. Well, what are the crew members going to do when you come up to them and tell them the ship's going to sink? Well, they're going to report you to Captain Smith, aren't they? And what do you think Captain Smith is going to do? I would suspect that he's probably going to come to you and say, now listen, you two, get your heads on straight. You can't run around on the ship here telling the crew members of the ship or the passengers of the ship that the ship is in danger of sinking. You know, you're causing a lot of hard feelings. You're causing consternation among the crew members. Now, shut up! He might even be condescending and give you a couple of more tickets to the A-deck lounge so you can have a couple of more drinks. Well, now, the only solution left is a grassroots movement. You're going to have to go publish a newspaper or go around talking to the passengers so that the passengers will put pressure on their elected representatives, the crew, who in turn will put pressure on your captain, the president, to take action. So let's go out and start talking to the passengers. Well, what are the passengers going to do? Well, they're going to go to the crew members and say, well, is this true? And if it's true, why don't you take some action? Who in turn are going to go to the captain, and pretty soon, you know, the captain's going to have you arrested and thrown in the brig for insurrection, for threatening and endangering the safety of the voyage. That's why we have these terrorist laws. You can't have people running around telling people what's going to happen or what's happening on the ship. I go around telling you, look, the captain is speeding up. He's not slowing down. Everybody says, well, we want a fast trip. Yeah, but they're speeding up the printing presses and they're printing more money. You see, we've gone from $3.5 trillion in 1987 to $9 trillion in circulation in 2000 to $13.5 trillion in circulation by the end of next year. That's the goal. That's why all of this cheap money is running around out here. One-third of our gross domestic product is now borrowed money. One-third. So we got an $11 trillion gross domestic product, and $3 trillion of it is being borrowed into circulation. It's just as preposterous as learning that the captain is steering into a field of icebergs 5,000 square miles in size, and he is speeded up by 3 miles an hour. No, if we're approaching icebergs, we should be slowing down and steering south, not speeding up and steering north. I mean, my common sense tells me that, but that's exactly what the Titanic did. Well, now, you think about this dilemma, and assuming that we get away without getting thrown in the brig, you know, it's about time for us to wake up and say, look, the captain won't listen, the crew won't listen, the passengers won't listen. And furthermore, do I have some duty to save the people on the Titanic? I'll be doing a big job if I could save myself off of this deal. So I think what I'll do is I'll lash a bunch of deck chairs together up in the bow of the ship. Remember, I had the dream, and I know the ship is going to sink by the bow. So I'm going to put my deck chairs together. I'll put them up in the bow of the ship. And then I'll cover them with a tarp. just in case, you know. I hope the ship doesn't hit an iceberg. I hope it doesn't sink. I hope I get off of here with my life, but I'm not sure. I'm really concerned about this. Hasn't happened yet. It's the safest ship in the world. It's unsinkable, they tell me. Can't happen in America. Biggest, most robust economy in the world, isn't it? All right, so the ship hits the ice at precisely 20 minutes to 12, just like my dream told me. And now they tell us to put on our life vests. The ocean water is 28 degrees. There's no life out there in that water. So I'm standing in front of lifeboat 6, but just in case I don't get on it, I've got my life raft up in the front of the ship, don't I? Don't you think you ought to have a safety plan? Don't you think you ought to have some plan in place just in case the economy collapses? Not that it's going to, of course. This is America. It can't happen here, but just in case. And when it occurs, you're going to see George Gordon saying, "Excuse me, pardon me, let me through, please." All of the people on the Titanic are fleeing to the stern as the bow goes underwater. And George Gordon is saying, "Excuse me, pardon me." Wouldn't you say, wait a minute, the bow is underwater. Turn around, flee to the stern. Now, that's pretty logical. Pretty logical. Is this the time for me to say, "Hold it, hold it. I've got a life raft up in the bow. Follow me." My little life raft, the little life raft that George Gordon had, isn't going to be big enough for all the people of America. I can't save 300 million people. The President of the United States might be able to do something. But I think that unfortunately for America, we've already hit the iceberg. The ship has already taken on water. We're at a place in our history where this thing is now insolvable. We're not going to make any major changes. What we're going to do is see some survivors and some victims get off of here. And unfortunately, our captain and crew have not even been honest enough to tell us the ship is sinking. The American ship is sinking. It's time for us to take action. Stand by. I'll be right back right after this. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events from the scriptural perspective, and we do that 7 days a week. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are believed to be true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. And The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to the authors and publishers used on this program and often endorses and recommends books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements are recommendations that we give. It doesn't necessarily mean that the authors or the publications that we recommend or endorse will reciprocate. And that's because most of the authors and the publications cited on The Law Hour are political, religious, economic, or sectarian. They're racial or ethnic partisans who do not necessarily endorse the opinions or beliefs expressed here on The Law Hour and Editorial Review. All right, we're reviewing The Privateer. Now, remember, The Privateer is available. I recommend it highly. I don't know whether Mr. Buckler recommends The Law Hour or not, but we recommend The Privateer. This guy makes more sense than most of the newsletter writers. Well, he makes more sense. Most of them make good sense, but this guy makes a little more sense. And the numbers that he's citing, you come right from the Treasury and right from official United States publications. So if they're inaccurate or incorrect, it's the government that's telling us. And the government's not even trying to hide it. I mean, they're not getting out here and publishing it on CBS Evening News, but the numbers are published, whether you see them or not. It's published by William A.M. Buckler, Post Office Box 2004, Noosa Heads, Queensland, Australia, with a number 4567. I assume that that is the zip code. Or you can take a look at their website. It's www.the-privateer.com. Again, that's www.the-privateer.com. The email is capt@the-privateer.com. capt@the-privateer.com. $180 Australian, $130 American. I'd call them or write them an email before I send them a check or money order. But if you can get subscribed or if you can get set up and buy a subscription, I hardly recommend it. All right, going on. This total credit market borrowings, the non-financial and financial in the United States increased by $2.59 trillion. This is a monster U.S. credit machine. $2.5 trillion seasonally adjusted and annualized to the rate of $35 trillion a year. These are all funded debts. I mean, we're not talking billions of dollars anymore, boys and girls. I mean, we're up into the trillions of dollars now. My God, I can remember when America had its first $100 billion a year budget. It was President Kennedy that proposed it in 1961, the first time that the American or the U.S. federal budget hit $100 billion. Now it's a tenth of a trillion. Now look at us. Our national budget is approaching $3 trillion. Just the borrowings, the deficit, is in the trillions of dollars. And that's where we're at today. Now, the data above is right out of the latest official U.S. financial data. Here we have a U.S. economy measured at $11.6 trillion in annual gross domestic product. Now, those are the latest figures in U.S. dollars, $11.6 trillion a year. That's what we crank out in the U.S. economy every year. Now, we're also cranking out $2.59 trillion in additional new credit this year. This is the same economically as saying that were the U.S. credit expansion to end tomorrow morning, the U.S. gross domestic product would contract by $2.59 trillion. That's 22.3%. So when you make a comparison, or when you look in history for a comparison to those kinds of numbers or percentages, when a comparison is searched for in the U.S. economy or economic history, you can only find one, and it's during the Great Depression. And it approached 22.3% at the height of the Great Depression. The numbers in our economy today reflect the excesses of the Depression years of the 1930s. Now, if they stop, think of this, if we stop inflating our economy, we'll stop and fall over. It's kind of like Monty Python. The blunt global fact is that the USA can no longer stop its own internal credit expansion, because if we do, we collapse. To do so would bring about a sharp backward slide of the U.S. gross domestic product with an accompanying fast slide into an internal economic recession, dragging the rest of the world down with us. So if the U.S. banking and financial systems could not handle that, the situation would compound into the bankruptcy of many lenders, in turn deepening the U.S. recession with a high likelihood of driving the U.S. economy into real economic depression territory. Now, the U.S. political establishment, which stands behind all of these current political actors on stage, knows full well that such an outcome might make them lose their current hold on the American people. So at a minimum, it will certainly make many or most of the current political actors lose their hold on their high offices. That's why neither U.S. establishment figures nor U.S. politicians are telling the economic truth to the American public. And it also tells us why the people who could have acted to change U.S. policy, the establishment and its front actors, already know that their own futures are at stake, and if they stop or even decelerate the U.S. credit surge, it'll throw us into recession. So the president has got the spigots wide open. We're printing money like it's going out of style. And of course, that has economic consequences for you and me. Now, I don't hold any dollar-denominated assets. I got out of dollars a long time ago. And Warren Buffett, you know, this newspaper and media mogul, he's reported to have a fortune of around $35 billion. That's quite a little chunk of change. He has taken all of his wealth out of American dollars. Think of that. You think maybe this guy, Warren Buffett, knows something that you and I ought to know. So if you've got a house and you've got assets and you've got debts, you know, your common sense comes into play and says, you know, I need to unload and I need to stock up. I need to collect my assets and get very liquid very fast. It's already late in the game, but the game isn't over yet. Now, James Turk, I put this interview on last week. James Turk says that he thinks that it's going to occur in the next 3 years. Well, it's good, because that gives you a year or 2 years or 3 years to get prepared. I was prepared 3 years ago, so I'm prepared and ready today. Now, there's economic opportunity here. Not only is there the potential for great economic loss, there's also the potential for great economic gain. And what you need is to turn your assets, your equities, into liquidity and get out of debt. So let's take a look at markets or external factors. Now, markets have a built-in capacity to take political actors and their hired hands in these central banks totally by surprise. The U.S. stock market certainly did that back in October of 1987. And there are two final outcomes which are rationally possible in the period ahead. Outcome number one is that the markets themselves, the currency markets and or the U.S. stock market, could be the place for an out-of-the-blue implosion which lights the fuses for the end of U.S. illusions and delusions about their nation's real economic, monetary, and financial condition. The outcome number two is the increasing possibility that some of the world's political and economic powers that be make the political decisions, that the least costly outcome to themselves would be to take the flow of funds currently rolling into the USA and to take them away. That is, to stop throwing good money after bad. You know, at some point in time, they'll either have to come to that conclusion, or our stock market will collapse, or a Bank of America will go bankrupt, or something. A trigger, something occurs that stampedes the horses. It has by now become crystal clear to both the markets and the foreign powers that be, that neither the U.S. establishment nor their political frontmen intend to act to slow down the current U.S. internal credit expansion. They fear the resultant recession and depression, and the foreign powers, the foreign powers that be, that is the Chinese and the Japanese, know that if they do stop the inflow of funds into the United States and precipitate the debacle, they assure themselves of the future enmity of the American political establishment. But past human political history is littered with examples of political establishments having bankrupted their nation's economy and financial systems, and then choosing external war to distract their nation from what's happening around them. That's why we're in Iraq. Iraq has a twofold purpose. It's a distraction, keeps your mind off of reality, keeps you delusional. And then number two, Iraq has all of this oil, 25% of the world's oil, about 100 billion barrels in round numbers. But you know, you take 100 billion and multiply that times $50 a barrel, and you're talking about $5 trillion. That's quite a chunk of change. Now, nothing personal with you Iraqis over there. We're just over there stealing your oil because we need the money. It's kind of like, I can't pay my rent, so I'm going to go down to the local 7-Eleven and hold it up. Now, political men in their nations, in other nations, fully understand this, and they know that almost all wars are started to disguise the effects of domestic, economic, and financial mismanagement. Now, I want to emphasize to you Republicans out there that I'm not castigating George Bush. George Bush has little or nothing to do with the economy. He's a puppet, a stooge on a stage, who is following his instructions. The powers that be are the Committee of 300. He didn't start the recession. He didn't cause the trade towers, trillion-dollar laws. But he happens to be president while this event is transpiring. So he gets the blame, or he gets the credit. Today, at the top political and financial levels of many nations around the world, it's general knowledge that the American political establishment has bankrupted the USA. That includes Bill Clinton, Dwight Eisenhower, all of the presidents that have adopted and followed this policy of free trade and fiat currency since Franklin D. Roosevelt, 1932. They all share in the blame. And that's where reality is located. And of course, we keep reelecting them, don't we? Well, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States, worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Gordon Law School and The Law Hour, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. Now, The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it's open to individuals by prearrangement only. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact discs. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on my website at georgegordon.org. Well, there's the signal that says my time is up, so I'm going to have to leave it right there. We'll take it up next time. That's tomorrow night, right here, same time, same station, God willing, of course, with the Privateer and International Geopolitics and Economics. So until then, good night, friends. Mm-hmm.